Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We're back.
So tell us who you are.
I am Bruce Burningham.
And where do you teach?
I teach at Illinois State University.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad.
I'm Robert. So Bruce, he's a scholar, a language professor, and I called him up because Jad and I were having a little disagreement.
Friendly one.
Okay.
We're having an argument here. I said that when you get the hip-hop and the wrestling and the novels and all that, you're getting a sort of a moment, mm-hmm. a contemporary moment, where people are fascinated by authenticity. And then Jad, my partner, said, I don't know, maybe people have always been interested in authenticity, and this is just comes with being a human. It's nothing about now. It's just about us.
It's new in the sense that this generation of which we belong has become very interested in these kind of questions.
But Bruce told me this preoccupation, it's not really new. In fact, at least in book form, it goes back way longer than you'd think.
1605.
Whoa.
Before wrestling and before Fleetwood Mac and before Jimmy Fallon began laughing at his own jokes, there was Miguel Cervantes's book, Don Quixote.
Yeah, so the first book really is about authenticity from the get-go.
You open this book,
Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes.
And right away, the narrator says, I'm going to tell you a story which I actually gathered from other authors, from a bunch of different historical documents, so I'm not really the author.
He says things like, well, some books say the first adventure was this, and some say it was that. So even from the start, you have a very unreliable narrator.
Who then proceeds to tell the story of a very unreliable, if not completely crazy, character.
Don Quixote.
Who is dry, withered, capricious, and filled with inconstant thoughts never imagined by anyone else.
So Don Quixote believes that he has been set on earth to rescue widows, princesses, and be kind to orphans.
He's like a delusional.
Totally delusional.
Right? He's essentially a guy who's read too many Zane Grey novels and decides he needs to be a cowboy.
He thinks herds of sheep are attacking armies. He thinks windmills are giants. At the same time, he has this savvy assistant, Sancho Panza, who seems to know what's really going on, and they're constantly arguing about what's real and what's not. And then in Chapter 8, something really strange happens. One day, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza are traveling down a road, and they see a carriage with a woman inside. Just an ordinary woman going, you know, to meet her husband. Don Quixote, however, for no reason at all, decides that she is a woman in distress, needs to be rescued, and he spies this man standing right next to the carriage. He's a Basque guy.
He sees this guy, and he decides that he's an enemy who needs to be confronted, and so they start fighting.
Don Quixote was charging the wary Basque with his sword on high, determined to cut him in half. And the Basque was waiting for him, his sword also raised.
And in mid-swing, when both swords are in the air, the narrator stops and says, and I don't know where this goes from there. I've run out of material. And he just sort of stops narrating.
And this is what, 1600-something?
1605.
The book stops?
It just stops.
You mean that's the end of the book?
Well, no.
So you turn the page and you're in a new chapter, and now the narrator is telling you how, as luck would have it, he found this manuscript.
One day when I was in the Alcana market in Toledo.
Crazily enough, he's at a bazaar, like a sort of a, you know, shopping kind of place, and he sees this pile of old papers and books together in a basket, and he's rifling through it, and he sees a picture of Don Quixote de la Mancha.
I was astounded and filled with anticipation.
There it was. Apparently a real historical account.
In which the stupendous battle between the gallant Basque and the valiant Manchegan is concluded.
The problem was, it was in Arabic.
And so then he hires a local Morisco, who is a Christianized Moor, to translate it for him.
All right, so you now got a guy who's writing a book from historical sources. He's run out of one, he's found another, but now that one has to be translated. And on top of that,
he frequently inserts commentary about the translation and will say stuff like, well, Sidi Amete says this, but we all know that Arabs can't be trusted, so, you know, take that for what that's worth.
And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, wait a second, this was written in 1605? What did people make of a book that didn't seem to have any author? It had author upon author upon author. Like, were they horrified? What?
I mean, the book was a bestseller. It was hugely popular.
Apparently, people found all these layers and these ambiguities a laugh riot.
Oh, yeah. They gobbled it up and they laughed as hard as they could.
This is Howard Mansing, a Cervantes scholar at Purdue.
And Don Quixote was translated into English in 1612, into French in 1614, into Italian in 1622. Everybody read it, including in the New World, by the way. Many copies of the first edition of Don Quixote were shipped to the colonies.
Wow. So the book is a worldwide bestseller, maybe the first of its kind. And then 10 years later, Cervantes writes a sequel, which kicks up this narrative weirdness to a completely new level.
In part two,
Don Quixote of La Mancha,
he introduces a new character named Samson Carrasco. He actually visits Don Quixote and Sancho to tell them that part one exists, it's a bestseller. And so in the very early chapters of part two, Don Quixote.
This would be like walking up to Huckleberry Finn and says, oh, by the way, you're living here in Hannibal, Missouri, but you're now a famous boy.
That's exactly what happened. Everybody he meets knows who he is because they've read part one.
And now it gets even stranger because in real life, during that 10 years that it took Cervantes to write his second book,
a person who goes by the pseudonym of Alonso Fernandez de Avellaneda published his own second part of Don Quixote before Cervantes could get his own second part out.
Wait, so this is an unofficial part two?
Yeah.
Today we'd recognize it as sort of fan fiction or somebody attempting to steal George Lucas's idea and come up with their own Star Wars installment.
So there's this unauthorized part two floating around. Miguel Cervantes is very annoyed by it, I'm assuming. So in his official sequel to Don Quixote?
There is this scene where Don Quixote is at an inn and he overhears a character talking about his relationship with this supposed Don Quixote.
Wait, so this guy...
That's Simon Adler who sat in on the interview with me.
This guy existed in the fake Quixote number two, is a character in that and is now appearing in the real Quixote
right.
number two?
Cervantes steals him. If you're going to steal my character, I'll steal yours back, right?
So now you've got the real Don Quixote. He's bumping into a character stolen from a fake book of Don Quixote.
So why Don Quixote then decides to confront this person.
He marches right up to the guy and he says,
I am Don Quixote of La Mancha, the same one who is on the lips of fame and not that unfortunate man who has wanted to usurp my name and bring honor to himself with my thoughts.
And so it's the climax of that scene, which is just wonderful, is he forces this other character who he's stolen from the unauthorized sequel, who Cervantes has stolen, to admit that the Don Quixote he knows from the unauthorized sequel is not the real one and that the one he's currently talking to is the real one.
I implore your grace, for the sake of what you owe to your being a gentleman, to please make a statement to the magistrate of this village.
And as a matter of fact, he forces him to sign an affidavit to that effect.
So he busts him.
He busts him, right.
In the novel.
Wait, you got a story about a guy that then becomes, in part two, a story about the story about the guy, including false guys inside the story about the
well, there's
story.
There are false guys from another book that are
right.
Now,
yes. So why even bother trying to figure out what's real?
Well, exactly.
Right.
Has anything like this come before this?
No, he's really sort of inventing this whole meta-narrative game that is so popular today.
But meta-narrative, what is...
Well, up until that point, most stories are simply... They purport to be what they are. I'm telling you a story. But Don Quixote pretends to be something other than what it is. It really is the start of modernity, our modern sense of the world.
So you agree with Jad, then, that this has not waxed and waned, this particular era? Because I think
it has waxed and waned. I mean, the Don Quixote has been read by different generations for different reasons.
Bruce says he thinks the people who were reading the book originally at the time of Cervantes, they actually
reveled in the multi-levels of fiction.
They loved the meta stuff.
But during the Romantic period and well into the early 20th century,
people were less interested in all these narrative layers, and they were more just thrilled by the romantic Don Quixote or the dreamer Don Quixote.
But this generation of which we belong has become very interested in this terrain that Cervantes charted a long time ago. You see it in the cinema of the late 90s.
In movies like The Matrix, and then later Adaptation, and then Inception.
We're exploring the concept of a dream within a dream.
see it in Seinfeld.
What's going on? We're going to shoot the pilot, and then it's going to be on TV the following week.
Yeah. Now, there's this comedian, Jerry Seinfeld, who's playing a character that happens to be called Jerry Seinfeld, who's making a show within the show about a character who's Jerry Seinfeld.
And so you have reality nested three times.
But I guess I'm interested in this idea of how is this happening again and why is it happening again?
Well, my sense of things is that both of these moments are moments of intellectual crisis.
Back in Cervantes' time.
Coming out of the Renaissance, you have all of this new scientific knowledge that is calling into question the foundation that everybody was building their lives on. So suddenly the Earth is no longer the center of the universe. It's now just one planet among several orbiting the sun. So you have people coming to terms with a worldview that they can no longer sustain.
And as for us, now?
In the last 100 years, you have Darwinism, you have relativity, you have quantum physics. I mean, cognitive scientists are telling us that we have no free will because they can sort of chart the chemical reaction that happens milliseconds before we think we decide to do something. All of these things tell us that the world that we think we see is not what it is. And I think that inspires people to then start asking these questions. If what I'm seeing is not real, what is? Who am I? And so I think to a great extent, it's a reaction to a moment of intellectual crisis.
Wait, but okay, let's say that I like professional wrestling a lot. I don't know anything about any of the research you're telling me about. Why the hell do I like professional wrestling? And why did I like it more when they started blurring these lines?
Ooh, hard question.
Well, I would say humans are humans. And one of the things that we do is as opposed to, as far as we know, what other animals on this planet do, is we are aware of our own contingency.
Meaning we can imagine radically different possibilities. We can imagine worlds where we don't exist, or maybe we only think we exist.
I can remember being a child, 4 and 5 years old, and going to a fabric store with my mother, and there were two mirrors set against opposite walls. And I was just fascinated at standing in between them and watching the infinite regress go in each direction. And I had not even started kindergarten yet. So I think humans have this fascination with infinite regress and with embeddedness.
And with the questions that it forces you to consider. Like, where does everything begin and where does it all come from?
I mean, the question at the heart of Don Quixote realizing that he's a character in a novel is, who stands above you? The author stands above you. And so that author has a kind of godlike relationship to you. But that very question starts to make you ask, who stands above that author? And if you start asking that question, it goes on forever in every direction.
Thank you to Rupert Boyd for coming and playing the Spanish guitar for us in this piece on very short notice.
And to Recorded Books for giving us permission to use George Guidall's wonderful read of the book, Don Quixote de la Mancha. He's really good.
Okay. Well, I guess we should go then.
We should say
goodbye.
We should say goodbye.
Hi, this is David Shoemaker, writer for Grantland.
This is Bruce Burningham, editor of the Journal of the Cervantes Society of America.
Hi, it's Andrew Morant, and these are the credits. Here goes.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn,
Thorin Wheeler,
Tim Howard,
Brenna Farrell,
Molly Webster,
Melissa O'Donnell, Dylan Keefe,
Jamie York,
Lynn Levy,
Andy Mills,
Kelsey Padgett, Matt Kilty,
Ariane Wack, and Latif Nasser.
With help from Simon Adler, Ava Dasher, Damiano Marchetti, Kelly Prime, and Danny Lewis.
Special thanks to the legendary Jim Ross,
David Shoemaker,
that's me,
and Paul Jay,
the director of Wrestling with Shadows, which you should see. That's it.
Thanks. Bye.
End of message.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.